Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm the mad scientist behind this enterprise, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is Dancing Automaton, Miss Anne-Marie Kelly. You get to be Robot Rhea.
I missed this.
And I'm pleased to announce that we have a very special guest. Ladies and gentlemen, the writer and producer of RoboCop and Starship Troopers, Mr. Ed Neumeier.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, Ed.
Thanks very much for having me.
Your sci-fi bona fides will come in handy because today's Sight and Sound entry is the 36th greatest movie of all time, Fritz Lang's nightmarish depiction of cities to come, Metropolis. The film was originally released in 1927. We'll talk about whether Lang's vision of the future proved prophetic. Then, as I mentioned, we have the screenwriter of a series of great sci-fi classics in the house. FlixWise fans will recall that we've already done a special Starship Troopers episode. But now Ed is going to fill us in on some of the details about the making of that film, as well as RoboCop. And he's going to offer up some words of advice for any aspiring screenwriters out there.
Don't do it. No.
Then we're going to close things out with some final words of positivity. All right. Are we ready to leave our humanity behind? Then let's peer into the future.
Carriage return.
First up, we have the grandfather of all dystopian future flicks, Fritz Lang's 1927 silent film, Metropolis. Here's a basic plot summary. In Metropolis, the titular city in which the film takes place, the social classes are rigidly divided between the laborers, or as Lang calls them, the hands, and the upper middle class, or the so-called head. The land of the laborers is an industrial hellscape. Every day, batches of hunched workers march in unison into the bowels of the city. They are expected to work and risk their lives to keep the city's machinery running. Meanwhile, the upper class gallivants around in their gardens and their swinging nightclubs without a care in the world. And the man whose job it is to keep this social stratification in place is Joe Frederson, the master of the city, played by Alfred Abel. Joe, the head of the head, has a son named Frieder, who's played by Gustav Froelich. One day, a mysterious, plainly dressed woman named Maria, played by Bridget Helm, wanders into Frieder's exclusive Playboy lair. As soon as he sees her, Frieder immediately becomes entranced by the angelic Maria. Frieder must know more about this mysterious woman, so he follows her into her part of the city, the world of the machines. It's there where he first realizes there's a whole underclass of people that sweat and toil every day so that he can enjoy his high life. Now knocked with a heavy dose of liberal guilt, Frieder decides he wants to know all about how the other half lives. He borrows a uniform from another laborer and goes undercover as a working man. However, once Frieder's father Joe gets wind of where his son's been hanging out, he commissions a mad scientist named Rotwang to build a robot replica of Maria, who will incite a worker revolt. A labor riot would totally destroy the city and everything Joe has built, and that would be bad. That means it's up to Frieder to bridge the gulf between the two classes, to play the intermediary between the hands and the head. And he must do so before Metropolis is left in ruins. At the time of its release, Metropolis was one of the most ambitious and most expensive movies ever made. But does the movie still hold up after almost 90 years? We shall discuss.
Bravo.
Nicely done.
Did I summarize that properly?
Yeah.
Okay, that was about it. All right, so do you like Metropolis? Ed, we'll start with you.
Well, it's kind of hard to... It's such a seminal work. It's such a gigantic work. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the Titanic of its day in a way. Immensely expensive. It took forever to shoot. If you watch it, you can see... these guys are pretty serious about it, and there are many stories about how harsh the circumstances of filming were. It filmed and filmed and filmed. I think it went over budget. And there's great, great, great imagery in it. The story is a little bit, I don't know, it's a little, it seems a little out of date now. It's a little complicated mm-hmm. and a little hard to follow, and even, I think... Fritz Lang himself later said in an interview that he didn't really like the movie when it was finished and that he thought it was a fairy tale to believe that all problems can be solved by the heart linking the hand and the head, which right. is sort of what the movie is all about. But it's an amazing movie. It has a lot of big stuff in it. a lot of big ideas in it. And the notion of the robot, Maria, you can see it all through many movies to come, all the way through C-3PO and Star Wars. I think it has, if you look at the design, you can see that Robotine pays some homage to it in RoboCop. The way RoboCop's face is kind of attached is very similar. It's the reverse of the way Maria's face works. Really, really influential movie. So, of course, I like it.
Yeah. Anne Marie, how about you?
Much the same. It's tough to say that I just like this movie, because I do like this movie, but it's so ingrained in science fiction post-Metropolis. Like, there is science fiction before Metropolis, and there's science fiction after Metropolis. I can only think of one other sci-fi movie that has probably been as influential, and that's Star Wars. But the...
Not Logan's Run?
maybe Logan's Run.
Close.
Not They Live? But it's, I think it does a lot to set up how science fiction would operate later in filmmaking, which is science fiction as allegory, as taking all of the hopes and fears and general zeitgeist of the moment and turning it into this big science fiction opera, basically. And I'm not saying that all science fiction movies work that way, but certainly a large chunk of them do, especially dystopian future movies, which we're in a period of time where we're making a lot of dystopian future movies.
Yes.
I do love it. I have two posters from it, but I also think that whether you like it or not, it's very prevalent and very here.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, let's talk about the allegory a bit, because it's a little. I don't want to say wonky, because that's a technical term, but it's a little confusing, I guess. I don't know if it's... this is notoriously one of Hitler's favorite movies, right? So did he just completely misinterpret the film, the allegory of the film? Or is it the film that's kind of doesn't quite know what it's trying to say?
I think one person liking a movie doesn't affect... That's
true. Doesn't mean anything.
Woodrow Wilson's favorite movie was Birth of a Nation.
That's true. Fair enough.
But as allegory, it's complicated and a mess, and there's a lot of biblical allusions to it, mm-hmm. which I'm sure with the majority of the population still being church-going in the 1920s would have made a lot more sense. But beyond allegorical references, wherever they're pulled from, I think it's a mishmash of the fears of the time. Like, it's a movie that seems to me, at least, to be very born out of fear and anger in terms of the massive amount of urbanization and industrialization and depression that was happening, economic depression, mm-hmm. that was happening at the time in Germany.
Right? Yeah, this is the post-World War period. It's the Weimar Republic. And, you know, the stories that I had heard, you know, of that from people who... were old enough to have remembered or have been there, were that, you know, this was famously when the depression, a worldwide depression is rolling around the world. Germany is harshly criticized and punished for World War I to the point where money falls apart. And during this also, they have a pretty healthy art scene going on into the buildup of this. Actually, this movie comes out right as Hitler is coming to power, or it comes out right on his climb to power, I should say. And some people say that it was an anti-Nazi movie, but other people say that they was embraced by it. And she, the screenwriter, whose name is Thea von Harbou, who was married to Lang and was really a prolific screenwriter of that period, mm-hmm. I think was probably interested in National Socialism. And I think one of the things that people don't get about that period is there was also great... No one was thinking this was, let's go have a Holocaust. They were thinking, let's go reinvent the world. Mm-hmm. Let's, you know, the world will be better. And I think she was probably a very optimistic person. They later divorce, Lang and Harbou divorce over, I think, politics. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to be part of the Nazis, and she does. Lang's interesting because he's this weird... He's Austrian, but he's his mother's Jewish, but they kind of are denying it, and he's raised a Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so he's got a very interesting mixed situation going on. And in fact, one of the reasons he does not go for the old Nazi thing, like his wife does, is because he's a little worried that he will be counted rightfully as a Jew, and he knows when it's time to get out of town, as it were.
Though apparently Goebbels was going to issue him an exemption and ask, he actually apparently asked him to make films on behalf of the state.
Yeah, probably in context, you have to realize that Lang, who's he's about 42, I think, when he makes Metropolis, and it's not his first film; it's his the middle of his early career, and he then goes on to make M, which is an enormous hit. So he was probably he could have been the biggest director in Germany at that time,
right?
And he may so he was. You have to think of him; he was like the Cameron or the Spielberg of of that moment,
right?
And the times are changing, so he's going to get out of town, and luckily there's Hollywood waiting for him. But
It's important to establish what was happening at the time because it helps to make sense of the film. And you mentioned that there's a really vibrant art scene, both in Germany and throughout Europe, and this film, as well as other films of the era, definitely incorporate a lot of visual motifs and maybe some thematic elements from...
Oh, hugely thematic elements.
Yeah.
There was an explosion of art and throughout Europe that also trickled into America eventually and made its way into Art Deco design. But it was... So you've got all of these folks like basically reinventing the artistic wheel in the post-World War One era, because, you know, World War One was basically the proof that all of these old regimes that we set up in terms of commerce, in terms of art, in terms of ideology, only create war. And so they get tossed out the window in favor of things like the Italian futurists, who are all about this new urban landscape, whether it's good or bad. And they don't seem to always agree on that. You've got German Expressionism coming in for the first time, which is amazing and beautiful and hugely influential. It's a complicated, tricky time. Nobody seems to be wholly optimistic about what's happening, but they can't argue that it isn't happening. And I think a lot of the reason why science fiction starts popping up in such regularity in the 1920s, I think it has to do with the fact that urban culture for the first time was a thing in America for the first time in 1920. Like, I think a quarter of Americans lived in cities of 100,000 or more, which had never happened before. In Europe, where a lot of cities had been destroyed by World War One, still people were flocking to the cities because this new urban landscape was being developed. And so a lot of art at the time was dealing with what does this mean when the entire population is moving towards a direction it's never moved before, and we've clearly burned everything to the ground. What does this mean for our future?
Yeah.
The thing that really hangs over all of this is the horrible amount of death that came out of World War One, and it's I think it's difficult for us to imagine because it was really everybody, a whole generation of young people was slaughtered. And this is really hangs over a lot of the decision making. So I think the time you get to the Italian futurists are, you know, doing one thing, and at the same time fascism is rising. And fascism is seen not as a negative we call it now. We see it now. It was seen as a very hopeful idea that governments could work together. They could work with people. People could organize themselves and follow rules and do good things and prevent the terrible thing that had happened with World War One. And I think also that death is hanging over this all, because in the thinking about future about fascism, that the futurists would politically they would really say, well, life is biology, and in biology, you know, the individual is not important, so we might have to kill some people. And then you get you that all starts coming in as well in the way of thinking. So by the time you get into this story here, into Metropolis, you have this whole idea of you know, the city and the divided into the two sort of labor and the upper classes and the wealthy. It's a little like what we think of now as the one percenters and everybody else. And life is cheap among the laborers, and the children are look like they're all starving in that movie. And
exactly, So I think we should make a distinction between German Expressionism and the Italian Futurists. It seems like there are a number of different art movements throughout Europe. We have, as you say, German Expressionism. There's Constructivism. There's Cubism. There's Dadaism. There's everything. I think these are all happening roughly the same period. But I remember in art history class, they sort of brush over futurism because what they don't want to linger on is like they're the fascists. What's the quote? Is that, you know, war is... It's hygiene, basically. War is for cleansing. So they're very pro-war, very misogynistic. But at the same time, they worshipped all speed and modernity, and that was just this big push to glorify industrialization, whereas everyone else seems to be very ambivalent about it. And so while the aesthetic of Metropolis is obviously very influenced by the futurists, the ambivalence, it shares much of the ambivalence of some of like German Expressionism, as well as a lot of the styles of German Expressionism, which we should also talk about, because German film at the time, they're making a lot of movies, very popular. So a lot of these films still endure. Nosferatu, for instance, that's a big one. Mm-hmm. Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, like the Golem, usually characterized by dramatic lighting, high contrast.
F.W. Murnau's The Last Laugh?
The Last Laugh, yeah. The Blue Angel, and then People on Sunday, Billy Wilder.
Yes, indeed. Though is that German Express? That seems more realist to me.
Well, I mean, I think more to my feeling always has been that was Hitchcock was wandering around in Ufa at a certain point, too. So it was a training ground, much as there always in film there are training grounds. There's places where people come together. So that Ufa was the training ground of most of Europe at that point, except for the French.
They do their own thing.
But I think the other thing about science fiction coming in at that time, and you're right that science fiction is... I think it's really the Industrial Revolution as it's starting to really hit post-American Civil War. You know, it starts to hit America. And then it really hits war with World War I. World War I is the first industrial war in a way. I mean, I guess the American Civil War might be. But by then you have the machine gun. You have all of this kind of stuff. All the technology is in place to have a really, really vicious thing happen. And, you know, it is a great turning point, that moment, because it's such a disturbance. And people start to have all sorts of, you know, ideas about the future of technology. And often I think one of the major ones we have to talk about is the play RUR by Carl Capek. I'm probably saying that wrong. And RUR stands for Rossum's Universal Robots. It was a pretty famous play in its day, and it coined the word robot. But it was about a sort of a race of autonomous robots who become the future of the human race when they learn to procreate. And that had a big impact on the world, along with the futurists. And clearly Maria, the robot at the middle of Metropolis, comes from, you know, is influenced by RUR and Frankenstein maybe too.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about artists today, I think we have this image of them being sort of like coddled and like precious. But the people who made these works all fought during World War I. Fritz Lang was a lieutenant in World War I, and no doubt had an enormous effect on him and his work. The art of the time, be it painting or sculpture, it was a means of expressing the inner turmoil of their experiences. Thinking of even German artists like Emil Nold or Kirchner or whatever, all fought during World War I. And it's these using color. Obviously, we don't have color in this case, but we have sort of harsh angles and everything. I mean, it's a very cool aesthetic now.
Well, it's all pushed. It's a little theatrical,
actually,
in the lighting, and it's very graphic at times. Mm-hmm. It's the compositions are very. They must have been incredibly fresh in the time. Mm-hmm. The acting style is what I was going to mention a little bit. Speaking of Bridget Helm, and it's funny. We were talking at some point earlier about the Giorgio Moroder version. Mm-hmm. Now that comes out in 1984. And I didn't really see it. I remember seeing pieces of it or whatever, but I had seen it. I guess I'd seen an earlier version of Metropolis in school. But what was interesting, in the early 80s, it seemed like you saw a lot of people acting like her. There were a lot of women who would be dancing, and they would be like, I remember Catherine Hardwick at UCLA Film School did a short called Puppy Does the Gumbo. And in it, there's a woman who's kind of dressed in half a flying saucer, practically. And the choreography of how she moves is very much like Maria. Mm-hmm. And when you look at Maria, and when you look at how the actors are directed in that movie, it's kind of amazing. And it also looks like it was exhausting, because Maria is on every moment. Mm-hmm. All of her movements are really sharp, and they're very specific. And you can almost hear Fritz Lang off camera going, no, do it again. Now do it here and here and here. Interestingly, some years ago, I was working with Paul Verhoeven, and someone said, oh my God, he's just like Fritz Lang.
Yikes.
He wasn't that bad.
Okay.
But Fritz Lang wasn't that bad either, I don't think.
Well, according to some people, he was a tyrant and an absolute nightmare to work with. But,
well, yeah, that's not Paul.
Yeah.
That's not Paul. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But,
I hope not. But what other themes are prevalent that we need to talk about in this? There's so much going on here.
I actually had a question to pose to both of you, because as I was rewatching it, it occurred to me to wonder whether this is a... Because we've been talking a lot about all of the context and how the German expressionists are a little bit more ambivalent about the role of technology. The futurists are obviously all for it. Most American philosophy and art that was coming out at the time was all for technology. And it occurred to me to wonder, do you think Metropolis is a pro-technology movie or a Luddite movie? Like,
It's pro-technology, because even Grot, the beleaguered and sometimes confused head of labor, or the hand, as it's known there, seems to say, what are you crazy people doing wrecking these machines? You're destroying, you're killing us all.
Right.
So I think it takes the notion that we are a technological society, and it's sort of a warning about how, the excess of technology in society, it's not clear as, what they're producing and how it works, but the notion is that that business is running too much and that people are suffering, and that we need to balance those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And the hope and power and almost magic of technology is sort of one of the entertainment things that's going on in this. The idea of the robot Maria must have been something no one had ever seen before. So that was probably a real fascination, and that she was this mysterious and kind of powerful, sort of a dark character in a weird way, because she has this, even when she's still just a machine, she's got this weird allure, this kind of exotic sexuality about her or something that is there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I guess the other theme that we're dealing with is, she was the... Thea von Harbou was accused of ripping off Frankenstein, but in a weird way, she's sort of doing the fake Maria, as she's called, is the robot, is considered, she's almost like the female id unleashed.
Mm-hmm.
And so she basically does all these anti-female maternal things, or anti-civilizing things. Mm-hmm. There's sexual abandon about her, which is interesting when you think about it. Mm-hmm. And then there's also, she also gets people to abandon their children.
Yeah.
And she stirs up trouble everywhere. It's almost, I mean, strangely, I don't see this as a kind of a, it doesn't really come off as a liberal film in a way, or a pro the labor film. It comes off as like, well, these people aren't really that smart, and we have to make sure that they don't fuck everything up.
Right, exactly.
And,
yeah.
Because they're crazy, And they're crazy. Things like technology is magic to them, and sexuality, and all of these kind of things make them crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to do what's right for them, I guess.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Still an elite, the son of the elite, the Fredder character, has to bring together labor and his father, the master of Metropolis.
Right.
So it's pretty much it's the old paradigm being played off. It's not a communist idea.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, it's true. It sets up a stratified society, but the end of the movie is not the stratified society necessarily being knocked down so much as bridged and made more.
Maria, the real Maria, who is shows up. She's kind of like that really cool college radical that shows up in the life of Fredder. And Fredder's never thought about any of these things, because he's been in the pleasure garden or something all his life as a rich
kid.
She's
Barbra Streisand.
And Maria shows up with some poor kids saying, look at how these rich people live. And then the next time he sees her, she's down, it's like in the bottom decks of the Titanic, practically, except it's down on the city.
Right.
Because Cameron also uses that upstairs upstairs, downstairs motif. And she's mm-hmm. suddenly they're there, and she's making an inspired speech in which she says there's a prophecy, which is a kind of a Christian idea, that mm-hmm. someone's going to come along and going to represent the heart, who will put the head, which is the upper classes, together with the hand, which is the lower classes, the laborers. And that's what the movie is all about. That's mm-hmm. what happens at the end of the movie. Fredder, mm-hmm. the child of wealth, actually fulfills his destiny. And I guess he gets Maria in the process, the real Maria.
One would assume.
Maria. Yeah.
It's, yeah. yeah, and I agree absolutely with that. It's also, these characters don't really exist as people. Mm-hmm. This is a movie that's very big on archetypes, which, yeah. I mean, considering how good Lang got with M and everything after that about creating character and really in-depth people, like creating people instead of just characters, it's kind of funny that this movie is all archetypes. Like, everybody's basically got a quote around them.
Right.
But science fiction is often considered the genre of ideas, and it's very easy absolutely. To make a movie that when you're doing science fiction where, you know, I mean, this was famously the criticism of Star Wars, you know, that the characters were so, the dialogue was this or that. And it is metaphor, and it mm-hmm. is more caricature. Or it's not really characters, they're ideas mm-hmm. as opposed to characters.
They serve their purposes very well mm-hmm. for what they're asked to do. I mean, mm-hmm. you're not walking out of this thinking this is the great humanist picture of our time or 1927's time. But they're not supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not there to be.
The whole movie is so stylized. You had a quote from H.G. Wells you were going to hit.
I did.
If you want to hit it, you should, because I want to go against H.G. Wells in a second. I want to say he misinterpreted the whole thing.
I think he did, too, because we're actually talking about that. So H.G. Yeah. Wells, the New York Times hated this movie, which I find hilarious because the New York Times hates so many things. But they published a full-page review about a month-ish after it was released in the U.S. of H.G. Wells just ripping into it. And my favorite quote from it was that the movie is full of, quote, foolishness, cliche, platitude, and muddlement about mechanical progress and progress in general. Which, since H.G. Wells was mostly so much about technology equals progress, I think it's not surprising that he rebelled so strongly against a movie that is not as clearly optimistic about the future or technology or any of that mm-hmm. necessarily.
Yeah, Thea von Harbou is not a technologist.
No.
Lang says he's interested in mechanical stuff. Mm-hmm. He's interested in the robot, he says. But mm-hmm. That's a very good point. Because Wells goes on to work on Things to Come, which is the other big epic science fiction film made mm-hmm. you know, in the sound era, which I gotta say doesn't hold up.
No, not nearly
to
as
Metropolis
well.
At all. But the point I would make, the reason I ask you to bring up, and I'm sure you have more to say about Wells, but that Wells is kind of misinterpreting what's going on here. This isn't a technology movie. It's not a realistic movie. It's actually very stylized, and everything's metaphor. And they don't care if the city works technologically. They just like the idea that the water is up top and it's going to flood everything in the end. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of idea.
Yeah, well, and I think it's also a difference between what was kind of going on in American philosophy and art at the time and what was going on in European philosophy and art at the time, which is that this is the middle of the Jazz Age in America, and everybody, like, it's much more of a positive focus. Yes, the World War I happened, and yes, it was terrible, but most of what's being written and produced at the time has a positive bent to it. That's part of the reason why Art Deco as a design took such hold in America. And also, they thought of technology as, this is the thing that I actually kind of love about the art that was being made at this period of time, is that all in American art and film, technology was seen as the as being used towards, like, this perfect capitalistic future much more. So, like, skyscraper was the ultimate expression of capitalism. Like, it was proof that our capitalist views work, because mm-hmm. we can build these gigantically tall things, and we can build these planes that go faster than anything, and cars that go faster than anything, because our economy hadn't yet been affected so badly by the war. And then you've got the Italian futurists, who are obviously taking a slightly different route, saying that that fascism is all about technology, and then you've got the expressionists. It's just everybody's kind of got a different idea of what all of these tools mean. Mm-hmm. The only thing that they can all agree is that it's all new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What an exciting time.
Yeah, I was trying to think about, like, I
that's
was
how
to,
Hitler felt.
Yeah. Well, it's how everybody felt. I was trying to think of if we have another time that's
like so radical, and yeah. I don't think we do.
Well,
like,
we don't have history doesn't repeat itself. It rhymes occasionally. I do think we are like in that. A period. I mean, it's not mine. It's somebody else said that. History does, I think Mark Twain stole it from somebody. But you know, we are living in a period that's not unlike the 1890s. Now we have financial disruptions on a cycle, maybe every 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. We have an immense amount of concentrated wealth within a group of people who see themselves as creating a new future, the disruptors of Silicon Valley, let's call them. Mm. And they actually have less money altogether than, say, Rockefeller and those guys had at that time.
Which is
terrifying.
But they, you know, and there will be swings back and forth because of that kind of stuff. So, I mean, we might get into something. I hope we don't get into sort of trauma of world wars, but we might see disruptions over and over again here. And people are, I think that's why technology is such an interesting and fascinating subject to people.
And we touched a little bit on the Marauder version, and I do think it's fascinating that not only did he do this 80-minute version with pop songs, which I've watched and actually kind of love in its weird,
it's
anachronistic,
fantastic.
Yeah, it's cool that did it.
But also artists in general, like pop artists in the 80s, inexplicably just locked on to Metropolis. Like it
pops up. I wonder why that was, because it may have been the Marauder thing, but it was something about the deco design coming in.
Yeah,
and
there was
Echo
Deco.
I think it was
80s.
Even before Marauder that people you started seeing deco coming back into stuff.
Yeah, because it's in Express Yourself, the Madonna music video. It shows up in a Whitney Houston music video. Queen did bits of it for Radio Gaga.
I wonder if it was because it was in public domain that you could grab that material and use it. And so you're at film school. You're at wherever you are, and you're taking weird stuff. Like, okay, the guys who started Corman were, at one wave of Corman, were John Davison and Joe Dante and Jonathan Kaplan. Joe Dante and John Davison in film school at NYU used to clip little movies together, and they would show them at the Fillmore East, and they were just these weird long things where they would cut all these things together. I'm sure all the public domain stuff was, I bet you there's lots and lots of uses of that in that period. And so probably it comes back into the consciousness of all the design people.
We've mentioned, like, we can trace the lineage of Star Wars and RoboCop and virtually every science fiction film made after Metropolis to Metropolis.
Blade Runner.
Blade Runner, precisely.
You could really, you can make an argument that if you just sit there and studied, how did they do that shot in Metropolis? If you could do that for the whole, you'd learn a lot about how movies are made, because that thing is so, you know, supremely executed on a visual level. And no one, you can't look at Blade Runner, which I actually worked on the set of. I'm that old. When I was a young kid. You can't think of Blade Runner, the opening Blade Runner, without thinking of some of the imagery in Metropolis. Paul and I probably never, Verhoeven and I, or John Davis and I, never spoke of Metropolis too much when we made RoboCop, but immediately afterwards, Ken Russell, the British director, called RoboCop the greatest science fiction film since Metropolis, which made me really like Ken Russell. And I don't know that they're that related. Like that the idea of the human being caught between the technology is a theme that starts in Metropolis and is definitely a theme in RoboCop. I mean, RoboCop was written. I actually had read a book once that said you should have a theme, so I did, and it even defined that the theme should be short. And so my theme was man copes with technology. That was the theme of RoboCop, and the idea that he was half man, half machine came about because I think originally the idea was he was just going to be a robot. But then one day I thought, it's a better metaphor if he is half man, half machine. And that's how that came about. Yeah. I didn't think about Metropolis. I did think about RUR for some reason. And I had an abiding interest in robots as a kid, so that sort of comes out, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I also like Dirty Harry, so that was really a big influence, too. Just like the screenwriter Thea von Harbou.
Yeah, huge fan of Dirty
Harry.
She
took everything she could. That's what screenwriters do, by the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We talk about how striking the visuals are, and it's so easy to incorporate them. It's like it still has this cultural cachet. Like Lady Gaga dresses up as Robot Maria.
Yep. And Janelle Monáe's Metropolis.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Exactly. Like there's still like so much mystery to it. Like I think we still can't quite figure out how they pulled this off in 1927.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of why it endures and why people still reference it.
Yeah.
And because the metaphors are still kind of hard to parse, and it's not completed. There's just so much that goes into the myth of Metropolis. And so I think people like using it in part for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. But it seems like a good place to ask the final question.
Uh-oh.
It is the 36th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. Do you think it is worthy of the 36th spot? Should it be higher? Should it be lower? I will tell you, it is tied with Jean Dielman, Chantal Ackerman's film, and Satan Tango, which is a Bellatar film. So it's got interesting company, slow cinema.
I can't really speak to whether, you know, the ranking is correct, and
yeah.
I kind of don't care. But it certainly certainly ought to be up there in the top of, like, if you're thinking about making a science fiction movie, this is going to be a movie that you can't have watched another film. You can't watch Star Wars without thinking about it, actually.
Mm-hmm. Right, you know. Exactly. Amory.
I think my protests to the entire Sight and Sound list are at this point well documented, because every time I'm like, it's where?
Yeah.
So I think it should be higher for exactly that reason. Yeah. I think it is so ingrained in the DNA of every science fiction movie that came after it that the fact that it's not higher probably just speaks to how ingrained in the DNA it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, science fiction is still considered a somewhat low genre.
That's true.
You know, and the fun thing about science fiction is you can get away with being a little low and still make a point.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. All right. I agree with both of you. I think it should be higher. There you go.
Oh, my God. We actually agree.
All right.
What is this nonsense?
As I mentioned in my intro, a few months ago, we did a FlixWise favorite special on Starship Troopers. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but it turns out that my friend Joe McBride knows the screenwriter of Starship Troopers. And so that's how that episode found its way to our guest, Ed Neumeier's Pod Player. Anyway, Ed has generously agreed to come on our show and talk more about his career. I'm going to try and keep this very casual.
Okay.
So, but let's... I don't know. Where should we start? This is me being casual, even though I totally have the questions in front of me.
Well, before anything else, let's talk about Joe McBride, who is, you know, who is one of my favorite writers about film.
Mm-hmm.
And I love his book, Searching for John Ford. I cannot recommend it enough. I've learned a lot by reading his books. And he's anybody who's had him as a teacher is so lucky. I mean, this guy hung out with Orson Welles and Peter Bogdanovich and everybody else. He met John Ford, and he tells really very great, good stories that you learn from. So anyway, you're lucky to have known him, and I'm lucky to know him too.
I know.
Can't say enough about
Joe. Oh, I know. Yes. Thank you, Joe. Okay, but on to you. So how did you always want to be a writer?
Well, you know, I sort of had no choice, because my father said that writing was the most important thing there was. He wanted to be a novelist badly, and he just talked about that all the time. So very early on, I started trying to write things, and I think to please him. And of course, he was a very competitive fellow, so it didn't work out very well. But the bug hit me. And the thing that really got me, I think, though, was movies. And the movie that really got me first was a movie called The Americanization of Emily.
Mm.
I was 8 years old. And for some reason, my father had decided to go see this movie on a double bill down here in Southern California. I grew up in Northern California, but we were down here visiting. And we saw it on a double bill with another movie called The Rounders with Henry Fonda and Glenn Ford in it. Now, this is only my father's, like, going to take, you know, an 8-year old to see The Rounders, which was kind of an adult movie. And Americanization of Emily, which was also kind of an adult movie. But Americanization is a really interesting movie because it's a satire. And the movies that I went on to write that we'll probably talk about today are both satires. And it's a satire about war, which probably is also true of Starship Troopers. And it even at 8, it sort of had some impact on me and that movie. And I started, you know, there were other movies, Lawrence of Arabia, Dirty Harry, Star Wars ultimately, that pulled me towards this career. But I became fascinated in, you know, the construction of a movie, like how movies worked, how special effects worked, how stories worked in movies. And the thing that I've tried to keep at all these years is the idea that movies are a visual medium more than they are a word medium. It's very important that the words construct a a visual idea, that, that movies at every level have to be kind of narratively a visual thing first. So anyway, that's not what I felt when I was, you know, 17 years old and trying to decide whether I wanted to try to go off into the movie business. I didn't even, you know, I assumed I would write or that I should write, but, you know, who knew how that was going to work? And ended up at UCLA, at the film school there, and, you know, one thing led to another, and eventually I was working as a story analyst, first at Paramount Studios and then later at Columbia. And eventually I was sitting in my trailer. They were shooting a movie right next to it, which was an amazingly big picture. It was and I didn't even know what it was. It was so big I would show up at night and ask, could I work on it? And they would tell me to do something. And it turned out to be Blade Runner. And I had been thinking about writing something. I'd wanted to write a science fiction movie. I was interested in writing an action. I was very interested in action because movies like Dirty Harry had been important to me. And I was very interested in blood. I really wanted to see blood flying. Mm. I was so interested in blood that I had made squibs when I was 16 out of firecrackers and stuff and shot them on film to see how that worked. So the movies of Sam Peckinpah were also pretty important to me. In any event, I'm on the set of Blade Runner, and I suddenly had the idea for RoboCop. I had the idea of the character. I had the idea of the title and the setting, you know, that was such an astounding visual thing that Ridley Scott had created was, I think, partially responsible for that. I think it was like it puts you in the mode to have an idea. And so that's how, that was in 1981, and it took a while to work out the story, but eventually that became RoboCop. Mm-hmm. And one day I had written a movie and I had co-produced it, and suddenly someone turned to me and said, well, you're a writer now. And so that was it. And I had to go out and figure out another movie to make.
Wow.
But I hadn't really thought about it until that moment. Oh, what am I going to do now?
Yeah.
I just had wanted to make a movie very badly.
Yeah.
And to me, RoboCop was also a movie where I figured I was very lucky in working not only with Paul Verhoeven, but also with the producer, John Davison. And I told John Davison at the beginning that I just kind of wanted to learn as much as I could. And he said, okay, well, then you're a co-producer.
Yeah.
And I was on that show from, it was sort of my postgraduate film school. It was, I just did everything on that movie.
That I could do. That's way cheaper than graduate school.
Yeah, no student loans involved.
That's way more lucrative.
It was very emotionally, it was a tough experience. It almost killed me. But yeah. But it was, it was a very lucky experience because everybody was so talented that the movie turned out as well as you could have wanted to, or better than you could have wanted to. And I saw it happen in front of me. So it was a little confusing at first. Mm-hmm. And then what happens after that happens is you think, well, I just have to do that again. But mm-hmm. it's really hard to figure out what
yeah.
you did, you know.
Yeah. Whatever strange alchemy brought
well,
you to
Well, it
that
is
point.
Because, you know, movies are made by people working together.
Yeah.
And when people work together and get along enough, sometimes a movie can be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a rare, unfortunately, it's a rare occurrence where mm-hmm. that happens.
Yeah. But prior to writing RoboCop, you were steadily working your way up.
I got out of film school and needed a job, which is, you know, so I decided I would take any job that I thought would teach me something. And I started reading scripts, and then I had a little sort of segue where I was an executive for a little while at Universal. And that was about a year off as a guy in a suit. And I kind of got there, and on the first day of the job, I thought, oh, I don't really belong here.
Really?
I learned a great deal. And one thing I learned was that I didn't want to juggle like 100 projects. I wanted to do one project. And so RoboCop, actually, the whole idea of being an executive came out of this experience. And the old man in RoboCop was based on the then head of Universal, Lou Wasserman, who you would occasionally run into in the elevator. It was, oh my God, it was so frightening. I saw John Landis once, and I got into an elevator, and it was John Landis and Lou Wasserman. And John Landis was really nervous, and he was one of the most successful directors around at the moment. And he was trying to impress Wasserman in a very nice way. And he said, you know, Mr. Wasserman, it's funny, but the movie that's I made the most money on, that Thriller video I did with Michael Jackson, more than any of the pictures. And I guess he had made a lot of money on it. And Wasserman just, you could tell, couldn't care. But that was the sort of environment, again, very creative for me, because the idea of boardroom meetings and marketing meetings was something I was going through right around the time I was writing the first draft of RoboCop.
Yeah.
And in fact, I told them my grandfather had been dead many years, but I was trying to get a draft done. So I said, oh, my grandfather's died. I have to go away for a week. So I went away for a week to write the first act of RoboCop. And they sent me flowers. And I felt so guilty. But I did offer it to Universal before, you know, when it was ready. And they didn't want it. They actually told me that I should, you know, that I'd gotten it wrong. That the way to do these things was that it was a machine on the inside, but a man, it looked like a man on the outside, like the $6 million man, which was their show. But I disagreed.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, the training, I got out of school, and it was about 10 years. It was fast, but it was really 10 years from the time I got out of UCLA, you know, to the time the movie was in the theaters in 87.
Wow.
And it turned out very well. And it's, you know, there's an old expression about how, you know, I think Kipling says, you know, you meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostures the same. And it's very true that a big success is about as bad as a disaster, because it's very, it just throws everything up in the air, and you have to recover from it as well. So, you know, I wrote after RoboCop, we wrote a bunch of things. We almost had things made. Then eventually my writing partner and I, Mike Miner, decided we shouldn't write together anymore, which was a good thing. And then I wrote, then I started writing Starship Troopers, which eventually got made with Paul. And it's kind of, in a strange way, the sequel, or it's the next movie.
We'll talk about the genesis of that, because I remember you told me a story about how you and Paul Verhoeven were talking on set of RoboCop.
It goes back to RoboCop, and in the final awful days of production in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, when no one on the crew would talk to either of us, we would spend a lot of time together. And on a Sunday, we went walking out in the hills around this steel plant where we were shooting, if you remember the movie. And we had a long conversation about what we would like to do if we did something else together. And Paul said that he'd always wanted to make a movie about young people in, you know, 1935, 36, when no one knew that it was bad to be a Nazi, and that it was the most exciting thing there was going. And he was interested in the idea that, you know, these kids in some ways are a victim of their culture. They don't know. They can't. They're coming into the world. And this is, and the notion, you know, having grown up post-World War II, of the idea that you didn't know yet what history was going to do was intriguing to me. But I remember saying to him at the time, oh, well, they're not going to let us make that movie about World War II. I mean, my God. Right. And then I was thinking, a couple years later, I was thinking about Starship Troopers, which I'd read, the Robert Heinlein book that I'd read when I was about 13. And I suddenly realized that was the way you could do it. And so the genesis was, I actually went to John Davison, my producer, who was friend, we were friends with Phil Tippett. Phil Tippett had done the stop-motion Ed 209 robot in RoboCop. Cut to 1992, and he's working for Steven Spielberg, and they've just released Jurassic Park, or 93, whenever it was. And Jurassic Park changes the world. That's the line where the world goes to digital. Mm-hmm. And so since we knew Phil, I said, well, we can do the bugs of Starship Troopers. And the first thing I gave him, I didn't think we could get the rights to it, so I kind of wrote a Starship Troopers-like treatment, which was really about a war in the future against giant bugs. And it was it had a love triangle in it, and which is implied in the book, but not really. And so Davison and I took it to Columbia, and we had the worst pitch. I'm terrible at pitching, so I was equally terrible that day too, and they kind of weren't that. Oh well, we don't get it. And so Davison, as a good producer, went and checked to see if the rights were available for Starship Troopers, and it turned out no one had ever optioned the book, even though Jim Cameron had already been inspired by it for the Aliens, you know, and he even has the guys say things like Bug Hunt, mm-hmm. which I never put in the movie because it had already been used by Cameron. But it is from the book. And it turned out the book had not, as I say, had not been optioned. So suddenly I found myself writing Starship Troopers, which was a little bit like wild because, you know, it's a book that's very important to a lot of people. And I would go around in the next year or so as I was writing the first draft, I would, you know, run into people and they would say in a bar or a copy place or something, they'd go, oh my God, that's the book. That's why I joined the Marines. And that happened over and over again. But I also knew I wanted to do what I wanted to do with it, which was not to make I thought it would not be interesting enough to do a straight loyal adaptation of the book. And the book was, you know, it's a pretty much a jingoistic pro-war, it's pro-military book. The Heinlein estate did not like the movie, by the way.
They were
not pleased that it was changed. The truth of the book is that the book is really more of a polemic, and it has almost no story in it. Mm-hmm. So the story, as you see it, is sort of was the original kind of triangle. And then, you know, I wrote the first draft of it. Took a long time. Got in trouble because I took too long, as usual. And then Paul came. Paul wasn't particularly... I think he was aware of it, and I was writing it for him, but he was doing other things, and he was very, very successful. He'd done Total after that, and then he did Basic, and Basic was enormously successful. And then he was going to do this big movie called The Crusades at Carolco, but that fell apart because of a movie called Cutthroat Island, and instead he did a cheaper project called Showgirls. He was doing Basic and I think Showgirls while we were developing the second draft. When I remember going over right before Showgirls coming out, and we were in pre-production or pre-production of Starship, hoping that this would be his next movie. So I go over to see him, and Paul is sort of in one of his, like, okay, I have a movie coming out now, so it's the greatest thing in the world. And that's what all directors are like, right? They have to be that. Either that or they're out of their minds.
Yeah.
So he was so obnoxious, I thought, oh, I don't know if this is going to happen. Because I don't think I could stand it, you know, and we won't be able to work together. And then Showgirls came out that weekend, and it flopped. And Paul Verhoeven showed up at my house on Sunday at about 11 o'clock and said, let's get to work. And we started, and he was like, because, you know, when, as I say, whether it's success or whether it's disaster, you're in some other state. And he was in another state. But he, just recently I asked him how he had survived the storm of Showgirls. And he looked at me and he said, I had Starship Troopers. And it was true. We just started working. So it's actually good advice. When something bad happens, you just start
just
working.
Just move on.
And move on, exactly. And so we started working. We worked on that for another year before we went into production. And then it was a very long movie, 122 days. And like on RoboCop, I was there for all of it and was in kind of the co-producer in charge of the director, and that was my job was to take care of him, and it worked out okay.
Yeah,
and it was the hardest movie anybody who had ever worked on it had ever made, and again we had very, very talented people, and I think everybody who worked on it is pretty proud of it. I think at the time it was so hard that some people didn't forgive us. I remember at the cast and crew screening, looking at the crew, which I hadn't seen for about a year, and they were like, oh, they don't like us. Oh, because it had been a very difficult movie. Not unlike Metropolis, but but not as hard as that. Anyway, but it was an unusual thing because you got to do, you know, we worked really hard, but we got to do what we had set out to do. You know, it didn't work out the way we wanted it to financially. I mean, it didn't succeed at the time. You know, it wasn't Star Wars, but we always felt that we'd gotten to do what we wanted to do, mm-hmm. and that we'd gotten away with something, in fact.
Yeah.
So we may have been punished for it as well.
Yeah.
But
well,
that's all right.
Back to when you were writing the screenplay, mm-hmm. you're supposedly adapting a jingoistic novel, sort of.
Right.
How did you go? But you always knew you wanted it to be a satire, correct?
Well, I think you can see, yes, I always wanted to. I mean, I think that's where I tend to go, is mm-hmm. I want to sort of be satirical, whatever that is, you know, make fun of things a little bit or point out things a bit that way. And so I always knew from the front that I was, on the one hand, we were going to make a movie that said, if you do this stuff enough, war, guess what? It turns you into a fascist. Guess what? You know, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really deny that. On the other hand, I wanted to also capture the idea that people who go to war, soldiers, are not bad people. And war is something human beings do. And we do it over and over and over again. And we are so far from being over war. I'm sorry, folks. It's just not going to happen in our lifetimes. We can keep working on it. And I think one of the things I wanted to do was just to say, here is how people act. This is how you act. And so the notion that it all kind of turns on the reveal that Doogie Howser has become this kind of, I mean, Paul actually dressed him in a Gestapo uniform. To make the point. I had just sort of had him walking in, and because you knew who he was and how he talked, you realized, oh, he's changed. He's different now. War has changed him. But Paul found a visual way to do it. And in that moment, the audience, you know, we always knew that this was the moment you holding the mirror up. You're saying, oh, what if you were the bad guys? And I think that's a fascinating thing that the movie does.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're the bad guys. And it's so interesting how we are willing to interpret that, because in the book, there's a sense that we were attacked out of nowhere, kind of like Pearl Harbor. I added the idea that maybe we had accidentally caused that reaction. I just thought it was more interesting that way, mm-hmm. that, oh, well, maybe we caused it. We don't know who caused it. But what I had really wanted to get to was, this is a wonderful world. There's no sexism. There's no racism. There's no anything. But everybody's armed, and it's a military state. And, you know, it's so funny how whether you want to be left or the right, at a certain point you become a military state. Mm-hmm. You just do. If you go to communist Russia of that day, it all becomes rather militarized. If you go to, you know, the Bush administration, the last one, you realize how we militarized then too. This was all before. This was written after the first Gulf War. And it imagined a war based on those things. And it, of course, it ended up, many people felt like we were making a movie about the war that had not happened yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
So I like the idea that you can make things that are about two things. Mm-hmm. And the notion of saying, or that are kind of complex, the notion of saying, this is bad, don't do this, doesn't interest me very much. The idea of having people acknowledge that they are part of that and think about it is sort of interesting. I remember after the first preview in Sacramento, there were these two guys in a bathroom who had just seen the movie, and they were really upset. And they were like, I don't know if I like that. I don't know if I like the ending, because they felt that sting of the ending, which mm-hmm. is like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I think so. I think the movie is successful in that way. It may, sometimes I wish it was funnier in places. It seems, it's a real, I ran into Walter Hill one day on a mix recently, and I'm a big fan of Walter Hill's movies, and he asked me what I'd done, and I told him, and he went, oh, Starship Troopers, yeah, that's an idea picture. And I thought, huh, you know? And I said, yeah, maybe it's a little too intellectual in its pursuit. It's not enough, it's not emotional or visceral enough, is it? And he said, I didn't say that, you know? He was like, but I took it, I think it's kind of true that it is a picture that's driven by making that point. Mm-hmm. And the point you're making is simply, again, it had a theme very early on, which is war turns us all into, you know, fascists. Yeah.
I would say, you know, that despite myself, did come to care about the characters in the movie, and I get really sad when Dizzy dies when mm-hmm. I watch that scene. So I don't think it's totally...
No, but she's an idea. She's an idea. I tell you, quite honestly, the movie, the form of the movie is Archie Comics. It's just, yeah. And I knew that. It's Archie and Jughead mm-hmm. and Veronica and Betty, and there's Reggie, and, you know, Reggie is always causing trouble, and Veronica, she's the dark-haired girl, she'll get you in trouble, and the blonde-haired girl, she's really the nice girl, why don't you go with her? I mean, that's what's going on there. And yeah, people really, the interesting thing that is how important that those archetypes are mm-hmm. and how people respond to those archetypes.
Yeah.
So after the movie comes out, and it comes out, when it comes out, it's like, you know, it's been this thing you've worked on forever, and then suddenly it was a little bit disappointing. And I knew it was not going to work. By the time it came out, I was the only one who went, oh, we have a problem. And the problem we had was one day my son, who was in the fourth grade, came home and said, everybody wants to see your movie, Dad. And I went, and their mothers won't let them.
Yeah.
And that was a problem, because we made this movie that, you know, so... Well, I'll get to that later as the rite of passage that both Starship and RoboCop are for kids, because they snuck in to see this movie and mm-hmm. they tell you about that. But, you know, so even then people would come up to me and say, well, you know, that thing about him joining because of a girl, that's exactly what I did. You know, I can't tell you how many people would come up and say, well, all of that stuff that you think, oh, that's how it is. One day, some years later, I was at I was trying to get some propane. It was 118 degrees in Pasadena, and I'm in this awful, like, rental yard, and there's a big guy, and I watch him moving around. He's trying to avoid me, but I finally track him down, and I look at him, and I can tell he's a soldier. And I said, you look like a soldier. He said, oh, yeah, I have three tours I've had in Afghanistan. And I said, well, I wrote a movie about the military once. And he said, Starship Troopers is my favorite movie. And I was like, and I said, well, actually, that's the movie I wrote. Yeah, that's a great movie. He didn't care. It didn't matter to him at all. And I said, really, why do you like that movie so much? He said, well, I showed that picture to all my incoming soldiers when they come in country. Before I'd put them out on the line, I'd show them, sit them down and make them watch that movie. And I was, really? And I, how come? He said, well, because in that movie, there's this scene, you know, a scene where the lieutenant gets killed and the squad leader, like, freaks out, can't do it. And then Johnny Rico says, kill them all. I said, yeah. And he said, I did that. And I
that
said,
was me.
I said, okay. I said, how'd that work out? He said, well, we all lived. And so whoa. That became the, okay, so however you feel about that. Then recently, I found someone sent me a picture of, in Afghanistan, the Starship Troopers cross-training gym with a big picture of Johnny Rico with a Merida on it, 50, like 25 feet tall on it. This was built there. The Canadian troops flew the mobile infantry flag over their camps. So this movie also took people into war.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
this
right.
movie, like the book did in Vietnam, yeah. and like, you know, other movies had, this was a movie that was watched, apparently, someone once said, well, during the war, someone said, this movie is showing 24 hours a day in the war zone.
But you made a movie that's sort of making fun of the people who worship it or at least admire it.
Well, and I knew this would happen. I had predicted to myself that this would happen because what was the greatest recruiting movie they had before Starship Troopers? What was the greatest recruiting movie that they had during the Vietnam War? Do you know? MASH.
Okay, yeah.
MASH was huge because, look, you got to go chase after nurses and have fun and you
play
know,
football.
Play football.
yeah.
And that movie is the most metaphorically anti-Vietnam. It's a great movie that way. You know, that's what happens when you make those movies. When you make mm-hmm. a popular movie, you can't say, I am not making a movie for everybody, mm-hmm. you know, and you will.
Mm-hmm.
Apocalypse Now, what do you think? Do you think they don't like that scene where they go in with the helicopters and the music? Don't you
yeah.
think they think about, they probably go in with helicopters and they're all humming that song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're right. In its way, I think Starship Troopers goes a long way in like questioning why we go to war and what our motives are. And I think that's, film plays an important role. More than like an anti-war screed, like if you make fun of it, I think that like that's, that calls into question, like I said, our motives behind our actions.
Well, Paul, when we dealt with actors, sometimes the actors would come in and they go, "Well, look, what side, you know, what side are we on here?" And Paul would always say, "Well, of course, you know, I mean, I'm not going to make a movie that's," but he would say, "I think it's boring. No one will think if we just make the movie that says this is bad, this is bad." And mm-hmm. and by the way, what was the last movie you went to where it was just preaching at you that you liked? It's,
right.
Movies don't
right.
do that particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah,
that's true.
You know.
See, it comes off as condescending. Like, what do you know? You make movies.
You know?
Well, you know, that's a really, really good point.
Yeah.
We're movie people. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are, as they say, the pie in the face people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really need to be taken seriously. I would like people to go see my movies and take them sincerely, and I would like them to react to them. But I don't really think who I'm going to vote for president or what I really think is probably that important to most people. I mean, and so I mean, it's not even that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But so I actually think that politics is not a good entertainment metric. And that's what I tell my friends who are always, they're getting mad at me because they want to make movies with messages in them. I just think, well, no one enjoys that, you
mm-hmm.
know. And so if you can find a way to put a message that someone can actually take out of it or enjoy, that's a good thing. But then that's entertaining,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Exactly. So. All right. Well, I guess that transitioned nicely into my last thing.
Okay.
Which is... What do you have any advice for future screenwriters or current screenwriters? Keep it funny. Keep it. Don't preach.
Well, I think you have to. You're first and foremost in the entertainment business. I mean, and you have to entertain. I would say for screenwriters over any, you know, a lot of things that we're talking about here would concern any writer, you know, of any medium. But for screenwriters, you've got to keep it visual. It is a visual medium, and you have to think of things in visual ways. And the dialogue should be crisp and fast and not too much of it, I would say. We really do need good writers here in the movie business. It's sort of a bad period, I think, for writing in a way, because I think we've gone back to kind of a more of a studio mill system where we have the script is something that's being worked on by a lot of people, not only just a lot of writers, but a lot of maybe executives and other people too. And it's all good if all the ideas are good. But the problem is things get murky and watered down and they just are muddy. And it would be nice if writers could write such good things that no one would want to change them.
Mm-hmm. That's true, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, writing by committee these days. But,
I think
yeah.
if you want to be a writer, you should watch a lot of movies and read a lot of scripts. You should go out and find the scripts of the movies you like and read them. If there's a source, if there's a book, you should read that. and just see how, that's how I learned to write. Mm-hmm. You know, you just see how things work. Yeah. And it takes a while, and it's not fast. The one thing I would say that the industry is always obsessed with is they somehow think if something is done quickly, it's good. And my experience is it takes a long time to write something that's good. Mm-hmm. And you have to think about it a lot. And they always want you to write it in a month, 3 months or, you know, or whatever. And, you know, most people will say an original script that's any good will take a couple years. And it really does. It's the thinking that you have to do about it mm-hmm. that's in there. So I would also encourage people to, you know, go long on their ideas for movies.
All right. I like that.
So what, when do I see a screenplay from you guys?
Yeah, we'll get right on that. Hey. Give us a couple years.
Okay. That's fair.
It's time for us to bridge the gap between the head and the hands. Anne-Marie,
very good.
Really?
From the bottom of your heart, what's one piece of pop culture you've been digging lately?
Oh, I'm not digging that metaphor, really. All
right. Bring it all back.
So mine's a bit of a throwback, because if you're listening to a podcast about Metropolis, then you probably like old things. And I recently, while writing a syllabus, tripped across an amazing resource that you can find online called the Lantern Media History Digital Library. Basically, some scholars at some universities in Los Angeles have been collecting all of the old issues of Photoplay, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, all these things that have now gone into public domain, and they've started digitally scanning all of them. So you can find Variety up to about 1950 now.
Wow.
On this resource, a ton of issues of Photoplay. So it's fun to just look through and just kind of revel in the old ridiculousness of Star articles from 1939, like how Betty Davis spends her day. Mm-hmm. But it's also just a fantastic resource for learning how the studio system used to work. And it's not something that you need. These are resources that were only available to scholars for a really long time. Like, you'd have to go to the Margaret Herrick and prove that you were, you know, writing something. But now they're just all there, and they're fun. So awesome. Go check it out.
I like it.
Lantern Media History Digital Library.
Nice. Ed.
I wish I had something that specifically good. you know, I guess what I have been doing is what I should have done, you know, a couple years ago now. I actually spent the summer watching Breaking Bad.
Okay.
Because I heard that everybody kept saying this is so good, and in television they kind of treat it like it's the Metropolis of television. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's this seminal thing. I was very, very impressed by it, and I recommend that fully. I have also been reading a lovely book about John Ford, Ward Bond, and there's a third party in there called Three Bad Men. Which, if you like John Ford stories, if you like John Wayne, Ward Bond, and John Ford. Uh-huh. And those were, that was a trio of odd guys.
Yes.
I won't give too much of it away, but there is a scene where, there is a chapter where Maureen O'Hara says she walked in on John Ford and Tyrone Power, and they were kissing. So,
oh my goodness.
Well, think about John Ford as a guy before LGBT
mm-hmm.
and trying to be that guy mm-hmm. and being an artist. You know, it makes you look at Ford's movies differently.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Yes, indeed. I like it. All right, mine, bringing it back to Metropolis, I've been reading a biography on Fritz Lang called Fritz Lang, The Nature of the Beast by Patrick McGilligan. Mm-hmm. And he went to Europe for 4 years and called together a whole bunch of research and government documents and interviews, and you get a really interesting portrait of the man who, it's not a flattering portrait, but it is fascinating. So if you are interested in learning more about Fritz Lang, I highly recommend that book. And also, there's a song that I've been listening to a lot. Myra English was a popular Hawaiian entertainer. And she had a song, like a local song called Drinking Champagne. And I can't stop playing it. I think it's magical.
I love it.
So we're going from, 1920s Germany to 1960s Hawaii.
That's a happy ending.
There you go. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Metropolis? Come let us know on our website, FlixWise.com. And how freaking good are Starship Troopers and RoboCop? Come on our Facebook page and gush. It's Facebook.com/FlixWise. Or you can join our discussion on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. But before you do all of that, be sure to tell the big head over at Apple how fantastic we are by rating us and leaving a comment on iTunes. On our next show, I believe we're going to do another entry in our female filmmaker extravaganza.
Whoops.
Which hopefully Anne-Marie is going to have a pitch for us. We shall see. But until then, Ed, it was an honor to have you on our show.
Thanks for having
me. Yes, thank you very much.
Indeed. Anne-Marie, always a pleasure.
I'm glad I made it this time.
Yeah. Okay. Listeners, set down whatever device you're using to listen to this and maybe go outside while you still can before you're sent into the depths below. That is the message.
Knowing tomorrow I'll wake up with you on my mind. Guilty conscience.